May it please the court, my name is Sean Paris, registration number 28080. One of the questions that is presented by the appellant in this case is whether the admission of non-testimonial hearsay that was offered by the defendant under Rule 804b3 opens the door to otherwise inadmissible hearsay in violation of the rule espoused in Crawford. The factual setup of the issue in the trial court was that the defense sought to admit, I think, what are admittedly or conceitedly non-testimonial hearsay statements that a co-defendant, Stott, had made to his friends and to his sister.
And to the cellmate.
That was Mr. Burrell, I believe.
Okay.
And so, with respect to those statements, the sister, Harmony, had denied that Stott had come to her to confess. But with the other two, that is to say, Maynard and Burrell, they indicate that Stott had confessed to some extent to them, especially to Mr. Maynard. Mr. Stott had explicitly said that he had been the one who killed Mr. Holly. In response, then, the prosecution sought to introduce the police interview that Mr. Stott gave to Officer the Police over defense objection. And in that interview, Mr. Stott placed all blame with respect to the specific transaction of killing Mr. Holly on Mr. Hernandez. I don't think there's any dispute in this case, looking at the answer brief, that the first set of statements were and are properly characterized as non-testimonial statements under Crawford, and that the police interview of Mr. Stott is, in fact, testimonial.
Can I interrupt you, Mr. Paris, and ask, is it testimonial hearsay when the purpose is that it's really offered to impeach? I mean, basically, it's a prior inconsistent statement of the declarant, right? And so, I mean, I'm curious as to whether, I mean, you raise here interesting confrontation clause issues. Now, I'm just wondering whether we get there if the statement, at least in the context of this case, really was, it's offered as a prior inconsistent statement. I mean, the defense does at some level open the door to that by saying, I suppose the flip side is if they don't get to do it, you know, where do you draw a line? Can the defense always put on non-testimonial hearsay that this guy implicated himself and the prosecution doesn't get to respond at all?
Well, I think there's some fairly well-recognized exceptions to the Crawford rule. And the most glaring exception is the defense doesn't get to look specifically to certain segments of testimonial evidence and then expect that all other segments of testimonial evidence relating to that one interview or one statement can be excluded. And I think that the case law is fairly clear that if you do that, if you just selectively pick out some statements, that the prosecution then can come in and bring in other testimonial statements. And then, of course, we have, I think it's footnote 9 in Crawford, that indicates that the Confrontation Clause is not really at issue where the purpose of the statement that the prosecution seeks to elicit is non-hearsay. And so I think at that point we come to the issue of, you know, what's the purpose for which it's introduced? And if it's for strictly for impeachment or credibility purposes, then we don't get the Crawford, and there is no Crawford violation. And I think the law on that is fairly clear as well. But that's not exactly what happened in this case. It's all well and good to assert that the purpose for the statement, as I think that argument has now been squarely raised on appeal for the first time. DA at the trial court level hinted towards bringing that in for a credibility issue. But it's all well and good to, on the one hand, say, well, we're only using it for non-hearsay purposes, and therefore there's no Crawford violation, when in fact the prosecutor did not use it strictly for hearsay purposes. They never asserted that they would introduce the Stott interview for non-hearsay purposes, other than to say, as I've mentioned before, that Stout's credibility had been called into question. But in closing arguments, more significantly, the people don't refer to the Stout interview to reflect on Stout's credibility. They refer to it instead for the very truth of the statements. And when I looked at, and this is from the trial transcript, September 9, 2010, page 20, lines 4 and 5, as the prosecution is making that argument, prosecutor states, and I quote, "Kyle Stott fills in the blanks, don't he?" And I think that's just a dead giveaway that the limited purpose for which legitimately the Stott interview could have been used was not used for that purpose at all. It was used as a gateway for the wholesale introduction of testimonial evidence for the very truth of the matter, to establish the exact set of events that occurred. And of course, there's three people in the woods, and only two of them walk away, Stott and Hernandez. So filling in the blanks is very significant in light of the fact that Mr. Hernandez never, at no point, confessed to or admitted to having been the one to kill Mr. Holly.
And what about his wife's testimony that he admitted he killed the victim?
I guess I'm not familiar with that part of the record where Mr. Hernandez confessed to his wife. What I'm familiar with is that Mr. Stott turns to his sister, who is Mr. Hernandez's wife, and Mr. Stott tells the sister that he was not involved. And then there's some other evidence that...
Well, Mr. Perez, let me hold you a second. Let's assume there was a Confrontation Clause violation. The state argues that that's harmless. Constitutional harmless error in this case says we should affirm. Can you address that?
Yes. So assuming for the moment that there was in fact a Crawford violation, is the error significant enough to result in a reversal?
Yeah.
In light of the fact that Mr. Hernandez consistently denied playing a part in the actual killing of Mr. Holly, and to the extent that we have the non-testimonial hearsay statements of Mr. Stott, wherein, for the most part, he incriminates himself with respect to the killing of Mr. Holly, and very specifically tells Mr. Maynard, in no uncertain terms, that he was the one responsible. And in light of the fact that a big part of the defense theory in the trial court was that the Stott family had, in essence, conspired to implicate Mr. Hernandez and not Mr. Stott, this is not the type of situation where you can say, well, there was other corroborating evidence of Mr. Hernandez killing Mr. Holly, and therefore this error, although it is an error, isn't all that significant and in the end harmless. So I think the factual makeup of the various statements that Mr. Stott gave to his friends and his sister, and the fact that Mr. Hernandez didn't implicate himself, and the fact that, as far as I can tell, there's no forensic evidence that either links this murder to one of the two defendants. It's, in essence, who do you believe killed Mr. Holly? Under those circumstances, this is not harmless error, because there isn't that corroboration. And we can't say, well, if we were to ignore for just a moment the Stott interview, the police interview, there's still plenty of evidence linking Mr. Hernandez to the actual killing of Mr. Holly. That evidence is simply not present in this case. And that's why the error is not harmless. And that's why on this issue, this first issue, the judgment needs to be reversed, and Mr. Hernandez needs to be given the opportunity of a new trial.
Mr. Barros, can I ask you to go back to You're talking about the case law, that, you know, rule of completeness kind of cases, or, you know, Rogers, where it was kind of the same statement. The defendant introduces the statement, and, you know, of course, the prosecution gets to put in the rest of it. Why, and I recognize we're talking about two different statements here. I totally get that. This is not really a rule of, strict rule of completeness in terms of it's the same statement. But why would the rule be different? The case law does talk about, you know, the defendant getting an advantage by kind of putting in half the story. You know, and in this case, if I remember right, the trial judge warned defense counsel, you're going to open the door if you do it. And so I guess I'm troubled just, whether it's a policy question, what would be the justification for a rule that says we're going to treat this one differently when the defendant kind of puts on, this guy admitted he did it. He admitted he did it. And, you know, the prosecution's sitting there with the 12 statements where he said, no, the other guy did it, you know, and they don't get to use it. That I'm troubled by how that would play out and the fairness of that. Could you address that?
Well, I think it just goes to the very core of Crawford, and I believe it's the case in Ray Riley that Justice Scalia cites in that case, where we have core testimonial statements given to the police that have an air of reliability and an air of, you know, the official badges and incidents of that kind of statement. And Mr. Hernandez at no point had an opportunity to cross-examine Mr. Stott regarding those very damaging statements that were played in front of the jury.
And I do understand that, but why would we say that defendant, by asking the same question, opens the door if what's coming back is non-testimonial, but he doesn't open the door if it's testimonial? I don't see that distinction. I'm having trouble seeing that distinction.
Because I think the non-testimonial statements, the excited utterances and those kinds of statements have sufficient guarantees of reliability, and that's why things under Rule 804b3, that's a factor to look at, whether they have that guarantee of reliability. Here, it's a police interview, and Stott is arguably saying whatever he can to save his butt from being charged with first-degree murder. And so I think that's a big distinction, whereas the other statements are more made in casual conversation, without perhaps thinking through the consequences or ramifications of the statement. And so I think that's a big reason for why to treat the non-testimonial separate from the testimonial. Moving on to the third issue, if I may. I assert that the trial court on remand misconstrued the testimony that came in from the jurors with respect to the extraneous information that came in to the case. Looking again at the transcript of that proceeding, in the order that issued, the court looked at some initial comments that were made during various recesses during the trial by an unidentified juror and dismissed them out of hand, in essence saying, if that information had been shared with other jurors, quote, one would expect more than one juror to have taken note, been offended or rebuked by the other jurors. The record, I think, is very clear in reviewing Mr. Cortez's testimony in particular, that one of the jurors had known the outcome in the case. And I think the trial court spent a lot of time with, well, there's no real good evidence that this information was shared with any other jurors. But the fact remains that that juror who knew the information still had that information, and the record is clear that juror had that information during deliberations.
Do we look at that under a deferential standard?
If the fact finding is not supported by the record or otherwise clearly erroneous, then no. And I think the way that the trial court sequenced the events in its order indicates that it was, that it in fact found some facts in a clearly erroneous way. Furthermore, for the jury to know that Stott had been convicted of first-degree murder and that he was serving a life sentence is per se improper.
But wouldn't that have helped Mr. Hernandez to know that the jury had, I mean, they're both saying the other did it. Why didn't it help Mr. Hernandez to have, even if a juror thought Stott had been convicted.
You're just about out of time, but
I was going to ask if I could continue with
the
answer. The prosecution, in its closing argument, said it wasn't just Stott that killed Holly. It's almost a tacit acknowledgement that Stott had, in fact, killed Holly. But with the jury hearing that statement, knowing about the fact that Stott had been convicted, I think that just bolstered their conclusion that, therefore, Hernandez is in this as well. And that, I think, is the ultimate prejudice to Mr. Hernandez from having that information about the co-defendant Stott and his fate and what happened in the trial court. Why exactly that's so prejudiced him in this case. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Carmen Morelita, representing the people in this matter. My attorney registration is 34852. There was no confrontation violation because Mr. Stott's statements to police were introduced under Rule 806 to attack his credibility, not for the truth of the matters asserted. After defendant introduced Mr. Stott's hearsay statements. And I think the record supports this. The prosecution's theory was that Mr. Stott was the one who actually killed the victim. Defendant was the mastermind, and both lied to police. And I would like to direct this court's attention to pages 4, 9, 10, 24, 47, 57, and 58 of the prosecution's closing and rebuttal argument. Page 4, prosecution argued it wasn't just Kyle Stott that killed the victim. Page 9, Kyle Stott was defendant's muscle. Page 10, Kyle Stott told his friend that he's the one who swung the axe. Page 24, defendant assisted Kyle Stott in nearly beheading the victim. Page 47, defendant lies to the police. Kyle lies to the police. Everybody lies to the police. Page 57, when times are tough, they both point in the finger. Neither one of them want to admit that they were the ones who touched the victim. Defendant is as much of a principal in this case as Kyle Stott was. Offering Stott statements to police for the truth of what he said, blaming defendant, was inconsistent with the prosecution said, as the closing argument shows. The prosecution case, again, was that they both did it, they both conspired. Most likely, Stott was the one who actually did the actual killing. And defendant is the one who, again, was the mastermind. In addition, the prosecution also argued that Stott lied to police. So it's inconsistent to say that what he said to police was offered for the truth of what he said, because on the other hand, the prosecution was telling the jury they both lied, Stott lied.
So then what, I guess, what's the relevance of that evidence? I mean, what, the statements to police, if you put on your own evidence to say he's a liar, ignore it, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. You can stand quiet and say you're very happy with the evidence the defendant put on, where Stott is admitting he did it. So I'm puzzled. I understand the argument you made, but I don't understand what, if given your argument, what was the relevance of that evidence?
Well, the relevance was once defendant introduced Mr. Stott's hearsay statements to his sister, friend, and cellmate. The prosecution under 806 was allowed to introduce any evidence to impeach or attack Mr. Stott's credibility, just to reinforce the case. They were lying, they're both lying.
But why would they want to attack his credibility when the statements that they put on were, I did it? that supported
the state, Mr. Stott's statements?
Right.
Well, Mr. Stott's statements, it is what he told his friend and sister and the cellmate. There is a mix of statements. Some of the statements were, yes, I'm the one who swung the act. Like the other statement is, we both did it.
Okay.
It wasn't just something incriminated himself and not defendant.
Wasn't there testimony by the sister, Hernandez's wife, that Hernandez admitted killing the victim? Didn't that come in there somewhere?
Yes, Your Honor, you are correct. I think she also testified that defendant changed the story several times.
So your position, if I understand it, is they're both in it up to their elbows. They're both blaming the others. They're both making inconsistent statements to others and the police, and the jury had the right to hear all of it to determine what was consistent and what was not.
Exactly. And if I remember the record, they both admitted being present when the victim was killed. They were just blaming each other. Defendant said, no, it was Mr. Stott, and Mr. Stott was saying, no, it was defendant.
Well, Mr. Hernandez tried to put himself out of the ravine. The victim was taken down a path and then into a ravine, correct? And didn't the Mr. Hernandez counsel bring out the fact that he was near, or he claimed he was near, but not actually in the ravine?
My recollection is that he actually eventually admitted that he was present.
Okay. Did the jury get a view in this case of where this happened?
Yes, Your Honor.
And whose request was that?
I don't remember. Okay. I don't know.
But they got to see the physical setting?
Yes. Okay. They all went there and see what the scene of the crime.
Now, there was one other thing I'm not sure I remember, but one of them made a statement. Who gave the weapon? To whom? Was it Hernandez who gave the weapon to his cellmate? Or what happened? It was someone gave a weapon.
Oh,
remember?
Yes, you mean after the crime, Stott sold, I think, one of the weapons to one of the friends who would then testify at trial.
Okay.
Yes. So, again, this court doesn't have to decide whether a non-hearsay statement opens the door to a hearsay statement, because that's not what happened in this case. And in any event, even if there was any confrontation violation, the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, not only because the prosecution did not rely on Mr. Stott's statements to police to secure defendant's conviction, but because defendant at trial actually used Mr. Stott's statements to support his theory of defense that he, Stott, was the one who killed the victim and conspired with his family to blame him. And defense counsel's closing argument trial shows this in no uncertain terms. And I'm going to quote him during his closing argument. I think there are two key moments in this case that you need to think about and determine what the facts are. One key moment is Detective Montes' interview with Kyle Stott. Stott, throughout his interview, referred to the victim as that guy. The prosecution knows, and the prosecution has told you now twice in the case, that Kyle Stott is the one who killed the victim. Later in this argument, we will compare my client's interview with police with Kyle Stott's interview with police. Defendant's position at trial belies his position in contentions on appeal. Unless the court has any questions, I would like to briefly address the second issue.
Can I ask you, just following up on the last point in terms of the constitutional harmless error, Mr. Paris argues with some force that if we take the statements out, what's the evidence that Mr. Hernandez committed the murder? I mean, I hear, you know, the evidence of conspiracy and they work together. Could you just be very specific and focus on that? Besides the statements, what is the evidence that Mr. Hernandez is guilty of first degree murder here?
Okay, so the evidence presented at trial was, again, the Mr. Defendant's statements to police. And we also have the Mr. Stott's hearsay statements. And some of them, again, not only incriminated himself, but also the defendant. We also have...
On a complicity theory we're talking about?
Complicity theory. And also he actually, I think... And then I think Mr. Stock's sister, I think, testified that the defendant confessed that he did it. We also have...
And that was Mr. Hernandez's wife?
Yes, okay. Correct. We also have Mr. Stott's friend who testified at a trial, and he's the one who said that Stott told him that he's the one who swung the axe, but they both did it. So we also have that evidence. And in addition, Your Honor, for felony murder purposes, it doesn't matter who actually killed the victim. It just doesn't matter. But I think there is, as to the first degree murder after deliberation, there is overwhelming evidence of guilt on a principal and a complicity theory.
Wasn't there a statement by Hernandez about the Xbox or about some problem he had with this victim?
Yeah, he actually, I think Mr. Stock's sister, who was defendant's wife at the time or before, that defendant is the one who had the Xbox, and the sister, the wife of the defendant, is the one who had seen him playing with the Xbox. And I believe that there's some testimony that the reason or the motive for killing the victim is because he was snitching on defendant. Quickly on the extraneous information, I think the record supports the trial court's factual findings that no extraneous information, i.e. that Stott was convicted and sentenced to life in prison, was actually improperly before the jury because any such information was revealed after the jury reached its verdict. And I would just simply point to the court pages 28, 44 to 46, 49, 50, 56, 59, 61, 71, and 81 of the transcript. This is the April 7, 2011. But again, even assuming that extraneous information was actually before the jury, defendant fails to show prejudice because, as I said before, defendant's theory of defense was that Stott did it. So that Stott was convicted only supported his theory of defense. As such, the information regarding Stott's conviction and sentence, I don't think, pose a reasonable, realistic possibility of prejudice to defendant. Unless the court has any questions, the people ask that defendant's convictions be affirmed. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. This concludes the oral arguments for this docket.